What's up, guys? You're listening to The Quest, a podcast that inspires founders and creators to seek eternal growth. I'm Justin Kahn, co-founder of Twitch and partner at Goat Capital. Every week, I sit down with icons and trailblazers from tech, Hollywood, sports, music, and more to uncover their human stories and bring you lessons in finding meaning and happiness beyond success. It's often easy to talk about winning, but I'm here to share the difficult stories that are often left out of the spotlight. I ask the questions nobody else asks, and you'll get the answers you won't hear anywhere else. I get a ton of Twitter DMs every day asking me something along the lines of, "Hey Justin, I want to be a great founder and I have this amazing idea in my head, but I don't really know how to start building it. What do I do?" I always tell young founders to just get started and ship something. Luckily, the days of needing to hire a designer or relying on VC funding just to get started are over with apps like Universe. Universe is not just any website builder. It's literally one of the easiest tools out there to customize your unique site that fits your personality. With this app, you don't need to spend hours sitting at a desk building your site. With their grid editor that easily lets you snap blocks into place, you can design and customize your site wherever you are and however you want, all from the palm of your hand. If you're feeling overwhelmed and don't know how to get started on your company, check out Universe and get started building today. We'll drop the link in the show notes. Hey guys, how are all of you doing? Hope you've been having a great week. Today, my guest is Chris Best, CEO and co-founder of Substack, one of the most popular newsletter publication platforms out there. And in this conversation, Chris and I explored the origin story behind Substack, discuss the effects of social media on writing and publishing, talk about how to effectively distribute your content, and we discuss the importance of surrounding yourself with the right people. Here is Chris Best.
Amazing. Chris, thank you for joining the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I'm super excited to talk to you. Like, Substack is amazing, and I just want to learn everything about it. So maybe we can start with your founder origin story. That's kind of what I ask everyone. Like, how did you get to the place where you were starting a company?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to talk about that. Happy to do interviews too with anybody who's on Substack. This is my new rule. If you use Substack, I want to talk to you. So I saw that you had a Substack. I was like, this is easy. Well, we should do this.
You should give me tips, actually. We'll put that in at the end. I'll come back to that. I want to like learn about what I should be doing on Substack as a Substack creator.
I'd love that. My founder origin story. So when I was in third year of college, I helped start another company. I was a technical co-founder of Kick Messenger. We made like a messaging app. I was the technical co-founder. I built some of the early code. I built the engineering team. And I kind of gravitated towards product over time because I think I found that the impact of the things that we build on human beings is the part that is most exciting to me. Like all of the bits and the pieces are fun, but they're in service to an end, which is what are we doing for people? That was a wild ride. We were up and down a bunch of times. We went 0 to 1 million users in 10 days, and then BlackBerry tried to kill us and almost did. And then we came back and built the thing up from nothing and got to, you know, tens of millions of users and raised money at a $1 billion valuation and then crashed again. And then we were going to do an ICO. And I was like, okay, I've been to this company 8 years. I've given what I have to give. I moved on. I guess the other thing I learned at Kick was kind of an appreciation for how much the digital spaces that we inhabit, that we are now building, shape our lives, right? You can't really change human nature. You can't really change how people think or how they are. But when you build a space that's the place they're interacting, you're kind of setting up the rules of like how people talk to each other, how people share things with each other. You actually can have quite different outcomes with the exact same people, even outcomes that are very different from what almost any of the individual people want, right? You can build a heaven or a hell when you're building one of these online spaces that we all spend so much of our lives in now.
Yeah, it's so fascinating how culture is really shaped by like it evolves in these different spaces, and you can have almost very similar software in multiple different places and the same people, but the way people behave on Twitch and the way people behave on YouTube Live or Instagram Live or something can be completely different,
right?
Even though it's, you know, the same people.
And really small changes, right? Like if you change the way that Twitch chat works, you're not just necessarily changing, you know, the thing. You change the character of the community that builds up around it. And that's sort of like an interesting and fascinating and important property of these things that we build. Which, you know, when you build a messenger that tons of people use, you start to grow a thorough appreciation for. Anyway, after that, my plan was to take a year off. I was like, being a founder is ridiculous. I haven't like seen my friends and family. I haven't read, like, I was like sitting at the local library, like reading books. The bargain I made with myself was like, I'm not even going to think about starting something new for a year, so that I know that I'm not going to be rushing into something. I'm not going to start something just because I'm itchy and I feel like I need to find my next thing. So I was doing a lot of reading because I've always been an avid reader.
Yeah.
Right. I believe that what you read matters. It shapes who you are. It shapes how you see the world. And I've always kind of thought that, you know, because of that, great writing is really valuable, right? Like it's this kind of like software. It's this really high leverage activity. If you write something important, you can change a million people's minds, right? You can create a lot of value in the world in a really scaled way. So I was like, you know, I should write some stuff. How hard could it be? Writing, easy, right? And I started writing what I think was what I planned to be an essay or a blog post or something that was kind of like detailing my frustrations with the current media landscape on the internet. I was just complaining in it, this piece, basically. I was like, hey, I think that the way that we've landed with social media, where we've got these engagement maximizing algorithms that determine everything we see, is just fucking us up. Can I swear on this podcast?
Yeah, for right. Sure. Swear away.
We've broken the seal on that. You know, it's and I had this myself. I have this love-hate relationship with Twitter, where on the one hand, I find it very compelling and I'm on it and I feel it makes me feel connected to the world of ideas. On the other hand, it kind of feels like smoking for my brain. Like I don't come away from a heavy Twitter session feeling like I've been using my life well. And so I'm writing this essay basically. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say social media is like, it's like sugar. You know, it's good in very small doses, but if you eat too much, you're going to get Alzheimer's.
Yeah, I do think that the information diet to real diet analogy is very deep, right? Like if I chose to just keep a giant glass bowl of candy on my desk all day, and then every time I like look over, I eat a candy, you know, I am choosing to eat the candy. It is compelling. Nobody's forcing me to do it. But that would be an insane way to, you know, try to like live my life and set my diet. And yet that's exactly what we do when we have these intellectual candy on our phone that we like checking every second of our lives. So it's bad for us individually, but it's bad for society too, in my estimation. Like I think social media is making us angry and dumb in a way that just isn't good for the world. And it's not because of nobody's sitting there tenting their fingers saying, we're going to build these digital space that we inhabit that's going to drive everyone crazy and tear us apart and cause all these problems. It's just an unfortunate side effect of the way that that business model grew up and the way that all the path dependent ways that the first generation of big internet companies played out. Wah, 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 I write in this essay. And I send it to my friend Hamish, who is a writer and who's sitting behind me. I don't know if you can see him there.
Yeah.
I was like, hey, I wrote this thing. What do you think? And he was like, you know, this is not as original as you think it is. It's 2017. You're writing, wow, wow, wow. I think social media might be, you know, the attention monsters that we've created are driving us crazy. This is not the most original thought that I've ever read. This is kind of a boring essay. And the more interesting question is not, what is the problem? The more interesting question is, let's say all of this is true. What could you even do about it? How could things be different? And we started talking about that. We started talking about, you know, could you fix it by changing the algorithm, right? Could Facebook, could Twitter, could YouTube just tweak the algorithm to like have different emergent behaviors, not drive people crazy? And the conclusion we came to there is no, because the algorithm actually works. It's doing exactly what it needs to do from within the context of these businesses is like drive engagement, drive time, right? It's kind of optimizing against you because of the business model. You know, can you censor your way out of it? Could we just say, okay, well, the algorithm's driving us crazy, but we'll take down all the bad stuff. I think that obviously doesn't work. I think you know, you had one problem, now you have two problems.
Yeah.
And the conclusion that we came to was if you wanted to actually sort of fix this, if you wanted to truly kick the social media habit, you had to create a whole different game with different rules, right? You'd have to have a different underlying business model where you, the reader, are not paying with your life, your most scarce resource, the time that you never get back. You could have a different system where you're just paying with money, you know, let's say as a writer, you could go independent, you could publish your own stuff on the internet, you could get directly connected to the readers who care about you. They could subscribe to you directly and pay you money directly. Like, this was already happening. There's already people that were doing this in bits and pieces. And if you can do that, you've completely upended this whole business model that's grown up on the internet, because now instead of having to write something that gets a million people to click it, you just have to make something that 1,000 people care about, right? You have to earn and keep the trust of your most loyal audience that are there for you in a thoughtful way. So if your Twitter feed is the giant glass bowl of candy on your desk, this model is like the considered steak dinner where you plan and go out for a great meal or whatever it is. Okay, we're still writing this essay. We're talking about this. And at some point in the conversation, it just became, this is a business we could build. Like, this is a thing that we could just make. What if we just made it so it was really simple for a writer to do one of these things? You could just start a publication. You could have a website. You could have emails. People could pay you. That seems really simple. Like, that's something that people could do now that would be the kernel of this big thing that we're imagining that could sweep the world. And, you know, I'm a technologist and a product nerd, and Hamish is a writer and has a completely different way of seeing the world and knows people in that space. And we just couldn't talk ourselves out of it. We're like, no, this is a good idea. Yeah. Like, this would work. And he's like, no, I think I have some friends who would do this. So we built it.
Why has Substack, or maybe first you could give us a snapshot on like how successful Substack is today, I guess 4 years later?
Yeah, so we've been growing steadily. We've got 750,000 paying subscribers. The top 10 writers on Substack make $20 million a year in aggregate. Yeah, it's been a really exciting ride so far. But I think if we're right about this insane thing that caused us to start the company in the first place, this is just like the tiniest kernel of what's to come.
Yeah, this is like you're at like 0.01%. You know, I totally see that. And I think that this is the future of media. But like, how did you succeed when other people had tried this idea? There were other startups here. Like, why has Substack become the one that has captured the zeitgeist and like everybody on, you know, if you're writing, right? Like, that's what you think about.
I think there's lots of people that have done something kind of similar. I think we were maybe the first to get just the exact right ingredients at the right time. I mean, part of this is just a little bit of luck, I guess. But the other thing that I would point to is when we started the company, it wasn't a bunch of tech people coming in and saying, don't worry, I'm here from Silicon Valley to disrupt your industry. Like, here's how you should do things now. Because I think there's like a reflex where people want to do that and it's hopeless. Like, the fact that we had Hamish and he's a writer and he actually knows these people and actually has done a lot of the jobs and knows the industry, it made us start out in a really humble way. Right? We started not by building some grand system. We started by going to a writer who wanted something like this. And we're like, what would work for you? Like, how could we make this? How could we get you from here to there? And so the first version of Substack was built for one writer.
Yeah. Did what was that first MVP for him?
It was just like, we'll give you a tool. You can send emails to people who are paying you. People can pay. Yeah. Once they pay, they get emails. That was it.
Which is still primarily what people want today, right? That's what people use today.
I mean, that's the core of it, right? That is the beating heart that makes the thing work. A funny story in that vein, actually, around this time we applied to YC. We started to get more and more grandiose visions of what this thing could become. So we applied to YC and we put in the application, we're making $0. And then in the 3 days or the week or whatever it was before the application and the interview, that first writer launched, and to everyone's surprise, he brought in like six figures his first day. And so we got to the YC interview and they were like, it says here you make $0. We're like, actually, we have an update on this front. And I think it helped convince them.
That's incredible. So how big of is their audience in order that allowed them to convert six figures in a day?
They had, I don't know if I want to get into like the specific, the thing that we share with this in general is that if you have a loyal audience, you can imagine that around 10% of them are going to pay.
Well, the thing I want to talk about is like, I think that for a long time, we underweighted how willing people were to pay for things on the internet. And with Twitch subscriptions, you know, Substack, and now like many other companies and startups trying to do this, you've started to see this transition from a purely ad-based model to other models of supporting creative work on the internet. People thought that would never, including myself, like we thought like it would never work for years, like a decade. You know, I started working on startups in 2006, and it probably was, I only really saw it working in like 2018, you know, 2017. Like, yeah.
I think the pendulum swung. I think that was probably correct in 2006. I don't think Substack would have worked in 2006 for this reason. I think there's been a cultural change happening, and it's making new things possible.
So you guys get into YC, and then what's like any interesting early lessons or insights from those early YC days, or, you know, right after?
I mean, a lot of it was just like the classic good YC stuff. You know, one of our partners, Jared, was like, "Have you launched yet?" And we're like, "No, not really." And he's like, "Let's do that immediately." And we're like, "Well, yeah, but do we have to?" And yeah, we did have to, and we did, and it was a good idea. There's a lot of just like good basic, you know, how do you make one of these things that we got out of that.
And so where does Substack go? Like, you've built something that's pretty incredible, and I feel like has empowered a lot of people to directly connect with their audience and directly monetize their loyal audience. And that's, in a way, upended the media landscape. And there's been a lot of pushback. You know, people, I think they've said like, "Oh, well, you need media brands." Like, I feel like the old media is kind of having a seizure and trying to like thrash out against it. Like, I've spent a lot of time thinking about how do companies and individuals own their audience and like create a direct channel to their audience. Kind of have that with YouTube, still disintermediated through this tech platform, but less than like if I was going to a reporter to tell my story or something. Now I can just like make a YouTube video about it, right? You know?
And your podcast feed is a feed that you control that goes, is a relationship that goes directly to your audience.
Yeah, my podcast and my Substack. What does the media landscape look like in, you know, as this trend continues in the next 5-10 years?
You know, I think when people tell stories of Substack, the thing that they glom onto is the famous people who start a Substack and become super successful immediately, right? The people that are like, "I'm quitting my job at the New York Times and I'm going to do a Substack, and then I'm, you know, the next day I'm making 3 times as much and having a big impact and it's working really well." And I think that's the thing that people kind of like lose their minds about. And we love that. We think it's great. It's an important part of the business. And I think it's a great service that we can do. And if we're giving writers more options, we're proud of that. The thing that makes me most excited for the future of Substack are the people who, but for this model, never would have been writers in the first place.
Yeah.
Right? The people who didn't have a job at the New York Times, who felt like they had something to give the world, but who didn't see a path to doing that that could actually be a career or be a thing that worked for them. And so they, you know, went to law school like their parents wanted them to or whatever. And we see examples of people who start Substacks who are relatively unknown, who don't have giant followings, who certainly aren't part of the, you know, the traditional media elite, who go on to have massive success, who feel like there was something missing from the world that they could give. They're writing about an industry, or they're writing about a subculture, they're writing about something that they think matters in the world, and they can make it, and they can not just make it and have an impact, but they can make it into something that, you know, is a sustainable source of income. I think that is the real thing that we are unleashing with Substack. It's not just a place for where all of the existing writers can have an alternate model where they're more independent and make more money. That's great. It's really about what is all the writing that we're unlocking in the world that just wouldn't have existed otherwise. That's the area under that curve is like the exciting piece of Substack to me.
It's just like Twitch in so many ways, you know, like inventing all of these jobs and enabling people to have this audience that they couldn't have aggregated on their own, or they couldn't have experimented. Like, it allows them to experiment their way to it in a low cost way.
How big is the market for video game streamers when you start Twitch? What?
But now, you know, there's tens of thousands of people making their living on it. You know, it's pretty incredible. So one question that comes to mind for me is like, how do you guys think about allowing people to maintain their independence as it looks like from the outside? It's a centralized platform. You know, you ultimately are sending out the emails. Like, you could be compelled to like take down people's content, or maybe from the other side, it might look like you centralize over time to provide more functions. Like, how do you think about that? Like, do you think eventually you are like worrying about deplatforming your users, or having to make that, even be in the position where you have to make that decision?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things here. The first is that we put writer independence at the center of everything that we do. Like, this is why people come to Substack in the first place. You know, you ask the question, why was Substack able to do this when other companies that did similar things didn't work? I think part of it is we could make people a credible promise that when you start your Substack, it's yours. It's your email list. It's your subscribers. You get to put what you want on it. We're not going to get in the way of that. You know, we want to make it easy. We want to make it simple. Our pitch to early writers was, we'll do everything for you except the hard part, right? If you can write a thing that people are going to care about, that's hard enough. That's all you should have to do. And we're going to make everything else, you know, vanish from your problems. You're not going to have to figure out how to set up a website. You're not going to have to figure out how to do your payment stuff, worry about email formatting, and even other things, right? Like, how do I get a designer? How do I get healthcare if I'm independent? How do I, like, there's a whole bunch of things that previously stood in the way of people's independence that Substack can break down those barriers, because that is what we offer. We're offering a true independence for writers. And there's some other things that we've done that I think help make that promise credible and kind of burn the boats on our end. One of them is that on Substack, you own your email list. So anyone on Substack can leave at any time with their list. There's no platform lock-in, which means that, yeah, you know, we're kind of like, as a company, we're like, okay, we actually have to provide enough value for you to stay because we're not forcing you to stay. And it also means that, you know, we have a strong commitment to freedom of the press. We very much believe that heavy-handed content moderation on a service like ours would kill the business and would be the wrong thing for the world. But if we ever went crazy and started kicking people off, it wouldn't matter because they've got the email list. They can go anywhere. There's no, we're not kind of asking you to submit to our rule in that way.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. It's like, it makes you have to be a better company in a way because you have to earn it every day, right? Like the day that like you don't earn it, the 5% or that's what you take, right? 5%?
10%.
Or 10%. 10%. Okay. The day you don't earn the 10%, it's like they can just say, okay, I'm going to switch off and like send my own emails.
Totally.
I hope you guys are enjoying the conversation so far. On this podcast, I always preach about practicing gratitude. And today, I'm thankful for our sponsor, Cash App, in making the Quest possible. Cash App is the best way to spend, save, and invest in stocks, as well as buy cryptocurrencies in a way that's easy to understand and accessible for everyone. From payments to banking to investing, you can do it all on one platform. It's available for download on the App Store and Google Play, so you better go get that $10 your friend owes you from 2 years ago. Now let's get back to the episode.
Amazing. And another thing I want to talk to you about is mentorship. I know you've spoken a little bit about that and how mentorship was important for you. You started your company super young, like I did, like when you were in college, right? And so can you tell me about like, who were some of the mentors that really made a big difference for you? And what are some of the experiences that maybe were inflection points for you?
Totally. Yeah, I think maybe appropriately for me, the writing has been really important. Like I think the Paul Graham canon of essays, even when I was at my last company, it was just something that I read and followed and cared about and kind of creates this worldview that gives a sense of possibility. And so I think for when we started Substack, one of the decisions we made was to come down and do YC and kind of just taking that plunge, which I did in large part, I guess, because of the sort of Paul Graham canon, brought me to this sort of world here that introduced me to a bunch of people that's been important. And I think even just taking that kind of a leap where you move to a new place and you surround yourself with people that are doing something wild and ambitious, where that's kind of like normal and encouraged, there's so much headwinds to making something new that having any source of like tailwind is more important than I think people give it credit for. So I'm a believer in all of that magic, I would say.
Awesome. Okay, so earlier I told you I wanted tips on like how to grow my Substack. I feel like people would love that. Like, what are the things the smart people on Substack doing to like make their email newsletter work?
The most important thing is actually just having an interesting perspective and writing good stuff on a regular cadence.
Yeah,
like that really is the magic, and part of that is because we've tried to design the system to make it so that's how you win. It works because you're writing something that people care about. One thing that I would suggest is you could put your podcast on Substack and it would be fully integrated and magical. Not many people know that we have a podcasting feature, but you can have the two work together and you can send things out as emails and also go out to a podcast thing and you can have subscriber only episodes. That whole thing works really well. So that would be an interesting option.
Tell me more. Yeah. So you guys have added other media types, like you're adding other media types outside of writing.
Yeah, so you can turn on podcasting and you can do an audio post basically. And what it does is it works like a normal Substack post. It's on the website. People can go and see it and listen to it right there. It goes out by email. There's a play button. You can just listen to it right there. And it creates the podcast feed as you'd expect. So it can be in, you know, iTunes and all of the various podcast directories. People can add it to their podcast app. If they've already got it in their podcast app, it just ports over. And then it all kind of integrates together. So if people are searching for it or if people are coming from the show notes, it kind of like pulls all of it together. So you end up getting people's emails as well, which is really nice. And if you want to, you don't have to, but you could do a subscriber only episode. So you could do, you know, only for paying subscribers. Here's something else.
I'm kind of sold. I want to experiment with it. Brent, we should, Brent's my producer. We should try it out. I feel like we could do some subscriber only episodes and
kick the tires. Tell me what you think. I think it could work pretty well for you.
That's interesting. One of the things I've had trouble with on the podcast side is it's very hard to grow a podcast.
Yeah.
Because there's no built-in growth mechanics, right? One thing I love about my YouTube channel is YouTube surfaces your content. If your content's good, they have an amazing collaborative filter or whatever, and they surface it to other people who will like your content. And my channel just grows over time. And I don't have viral videos. It's more about just producing the content consistently and well. And podcasts don't have that really. There's no, Spotify doesn't have that. I think they're starting to roll out more promotional spots and stuff like that. And but Apple doesn't really at all. So the only way to grow a podcast is by word of mouth or
by doing the guest trading thing that people do, going on other podcasts and
guest trading, me begging you after this for to tweet it on your Twitter, please, which doesn't even really convert that well off of Twitter, in terms of
totally
podcast, so it's the podcast trade is probably the best thing to do, where I go be a guest on someone who has a popular podcast and vice versa.
Yeah. The interesting thing is if you have a podcast on your Substack, you kind of have both. And newsletters, written stuff is interesting because it's inherently more shareable than a podcast.
Yeah.
It's easy. You can hit forward on an email. You can hit share and put a link to something. And I think it's harder to get me to listen to a podcast episode off Twitter, sight unseen, than it is to kind of start reading something and start to get a little bit of information for it. So if you tie the two together, then if someone likes the newsletter and they hit sign up, it's great, you're signed up. Do you also want to add the podcast to your feed? Boom, there you go. I think you can kind of put the two together into one feed.
That's which is why actually it's synergistic for all these platforms to have different media types, right? In them.
Totally.
Which maybe is another thing we could talk about because all of your, all of these big tech companies want to rip off Substack now.
it was amazing to see how faithfully Facebook had been inspired by Substack.
Do you think that will work for them? I mean, to some extent, it is helpful. With live video, it strikes me as an example where live video, it's very hard to make an independent live video site that's only live, like Twitch. It kind of needed video games as this filler content subject matter for people to have something to do while live all the time. And then, with kind of non-video game related live video, it kind of had to be embedded in platforms like Periscope and Twitter, and then live in Instagram or maybe in YouTube, because it was only one kind of content slice. And I wonder, do you think is that a fear for you with Substack and Facebook and Twitter trying to roll their own versions?
To be honest, I'm less worried about Facebook and Twitter because I think that, to me, it comes back to true independence. And I just don't think that Facebook can offer that to writers. Even if they say that they do, they just have this track record.
Definitely 0% trust.
There's sort of a 0% trust problem. And I actually think that is the most important piece of what makes Substack works is do you have this true independence? I think we have a tremendous amount to do to kind of live up to the potential that we've created here. And I'm really excited and feeling the heat and the
energy,
wanting to move fast on building all the things that we think we can build to help writers succeed, to bring them on the platform, to help them work together. I think there's a lot of network, people talking to each other, people having ideas back and forth, people interacting with each other, helping each other grow. And then other media types is really exciting for us writers who want to have a podcast, writers who want to do video. There's a whole world of stuff that we want to build with Substack that we feel really, excited and urgent to do. I think I look at Substack copying, or sorry, Facebook copying us less as a scary thing, to be honest, and more as kind of like a validation that we're on the right track. Like this, you don't get to make something that matters without everyone trying to copy you, I guess.
I feel like releasing my videos through it would be another way to access a different audience that's not necessarily on YouTube all the time.
I think it'd be super interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you got to put me on the beta list or whatever.
All right. When that.
Yeah. I'm actually pretty excited about that because I do want to combine the audiences, and make it easy to convert from my newsletter to podcast or videos, because I basically have all these disparate audiences, like Twitter and then Substack, which is pretty nascent. We haven't driven that much to it. And then like my podcast audience.
Email is kind of a common, it's like a lingua franca, right? Like everyone has an email. And if you want to have a place where you can reach your audience that you control, email is kind of like the last magical place that you can do that.
Well, kind of, except for Gmail put the promotions tab.
Gmail promotions, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's like, if there was some way to like, I guess you can opt. It's kind of like the equivalent of screaming about post notifications every time on YouTube, right? Being like, okay, smash that subscribe and turn on video notifications.
Yeah.
It's like, I need to do that in my Substack. It's like, put it, make sure to put this in your primary inbox.
Your main inbox. Yep.
Yeah. Maybe I should just record a video of me saying that. So anyways, you're right. It's like the last like non-disintermediating except for Gmail, which I don't know how much that affects open rates or whatever.
The cool thing that we have as Substack is people actually want to get the emails, right? We're not fighting against the thing where people are doing kind of like email marketing where it's, people really don't want it. We get way more complaints of people who expected to get an email and like didn't see it than people complaining, hey, what the heck, you're sending this to me and I don't want it. And so over time, it gives us a pretty good deliverability story because we just have people that actually want these things, but it definitely matters.
So what's your favorite content on Substack now? And what's popular, I guess, what's popular in general? And then what's your favorite, who's your favorite child?
I don't have a favorite child. I love all my children equally. I think the thing that I'm most excited about with what's on Substack is there really is a wide breadth of stuff. I think that the kind of the common thread is the independent thing. It's people who have a distinct perspective and have something to say. We've in the past lovingly thought of it as kind of outsider nerds, as people who are kind of like have something interesting and unique, some perspective. But there's not really one. It's not like everybody's talking about politics or everybody's talking about crypto or everybody's talking about cooking or everybody's talking about religion. It's like all of those things. There's like a really wide, somebody sent me a Substack the other day that did reviews of canned fish. And I was like, okay.
Reviews of canned fish?
Of canned fish.
Well, what's the best one? Now I'm like really interested. Like what's that?
I wish I knew the name. I should have known the name of it to give it a plug.
Okay. Well, just send it to me afterwards. I'll put it in the show notes of this, for this podcast. Like actually that, like I could see myself reading that. Cause like I want the highest quality, whatever, like the most expensive, it's not going to be the most expensive, but like the best, most premium.
Right. The best.
Yeah. I'm there. Yeah.
Totally. So there's kind of this massive profusion of interesting Substacks and the diversity of it is the thing that I'm most excited about.
Okay. And are there any surprising categories? Like things that you wouldn't have, I mean, I guess kind of all of those, I feel like the categories you named are like almost what people think are on Substack, politics, like, New York Times newsroom refugees, crypto newsletters. Like what are some of the like really surprising, maybe micro categories?
I've been following Lenny Rachitsky's Substack with great enthusiasm. He's a product manager from Airbnb turned Substacker, and he just writes about the craft of product management. And he's been pretty public with his numbers, and he's making way more on Substack than he ever was as a product manager. And it's fascinating to me because
Does that include equity?
You could dig up the post. I think it would be an interesting look. And I think there's a couple that are in a similar category that are people from an industry that feel like the mainstream coverage of the industry just doesn't really do it justice. So somebody who actually knows about it, who actually does that work, goes and makes a Substack and becomes massively popular because it's better and more interesting and, you know, actually covers the industry in a good way.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It's like instead of previously that you had these like full-time journalists who were covering every industry or whatever, but they weren't really doing the work of the industry or didn't really have the true insider view.
And they do like a rotation, right? You get like a person who's kind of like, you're going to be on this beat for a little bit, go and learn as much as you can about it and write about it for a year. There's value in having an outside perspective as well, but you're never going to be able to cover it the way someone who's done it and worked in it for years and years and years would be able to.
Yeah. Yeah, I see that. How's the pandemic been for Substack? Has it been an accelerant on the business? I kind of would guess so.
Yes, it's been an accelerant. I mean, the way I think of this is I feel like the pandemic accelerated a lot of trends that already existed. And a lot of those are things that are not necessarily going to go back. I think, you know, a lot of the trends of like people are, you know, looking to independent media to read things. People are living more and more of their lives on the internet. Those are things that obviously the pandemic accelerated, but I don't think it's like if the pandemic ends, I don't think it goes back to the way it was before. I think we just had the change we were going to have, but faster.
Yep. Sounds like San Francisco.
Yeah, sorry. There's a siren in the background there.
No worries. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I kind of see that across the board. And yeah, it's kind of accelerated the move to a digital world, digital first world in a lot of ways. All right, that's what I had. Those are all the questions I came prepared with. I feel a little light today. Anything you want to talk about that we haven't covered?
No, it's great. I mean, I'm excited to see you try out podcasting on Substack. If you have any questions or feedback, I'd love to hear it.
I'm good. We're going to try it. We're going to try it for sure. My team's all on this call, so
they're all sitting there rolling their eyes like, "Oh God, we have to do this stupid thing now."
No, they're the ones who told me to get on Substack and encouraged me to get. Yeah, so
thank you, team.
We'll try it. I love it.
Cool. Awesome. This has been really fun. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for coming on.
All right, that's my conversation with Chris. As always, if you like the episode, make sure to drop us a rating, subscribe to our YouTube channel, and check out all Quest-related content at bio.thequest.media. Hope you guys had an amazing week. Thanks for tuning in, and I will see you guys all soon. Goodbye.